Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another great hour with the FIA Group and our webinar this month, called The Tangled Web of Contracts. With me, as always, hi, this is Adam Russo, CEO here at the FIA Group. With me, as always, is Chris Aguirre, one of our attorneys, John Jablon, and say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
Ron Peck, our Senior VP and General Counsel, one of the best in the country. Nice to meet. Anyways, what we're going to be talking about today, folks, is pretty cool. Well, I'm actually writing an article about this right now, The Tangled Web of Contracts, talking about all the different agreements that we typically see in the self-funded space. I think some of these things will probably make people think, oh, wow, yeah, you're right. Never thought about that one. We put a lot of time and effort into this, and just want to say again, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy days and this time of year to listen into our webinar. We had a reference-based pricing webinar, I believe it was last week, Ron. That we literally set records on the number of attendees. Over 1,000 people dialed in for that webinar, and I can tell you that we had that webinar done on 2 days notice.
2 days notice, yeah.
I think part of the reason why we had so many people is because I wasn't there. So if that's the case, maybe I'm going to have to remove myself from webinars going forward. But to be honest, guys, it's just great to be back in the office. I've been on the road consistently for the past almost 2 months, so it's nice to be able to drive to work today and not have to go through an airport. But with that, let's get right into it since we only have an hour. We have a lot of slides to go over. So as always, folks, remember, please feel free to text us your questions and or comments. If we see anything really good, we'll make sure we bring it up at the end of the session if we have time. But we always respond to every person's question, no matter how simple or complex it may be. So as always, make sure you can email us at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. That's pgcreferral@fiagroup.com for any and all of your consulting, plan drafting, compliance, regulatory, ACA, state requirements, state regulations, any issue at all related to a self-funded plan. Feel free to type us a quick email, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ron and John, who are going to talk about some of, I think it's pretty funny. Usually we always have one person whose slide it is, right? For some reason this month, you guys just couldn't figure out who's taking the lead. You're both going to share the lead on this one.
Sharing is caring, Adam.
It can be fun.
It can be fun. Okay. So recent events, guys, take it on.
Thanks. So this first case here, Roland versus New West Health Services. This is a really great one, and it is not incredibly recent. It's been in the last couple of months, but lately we've heard a lot of chatter about it. And what this case is about, or I guess the lesson to take from it, is don't take ERISA for granted. ERISA gives the plan a ton of rights. Essentially, it lets the plan write its own ticket. It lets the plan do whatever the plan says with very, very, very few limitations on that. In this case, it was a plan governed solely by ERISA. It was a private, self-funded benefit plan. And it got sued in state court. Now, as we know, private self-funded benefit plans, where the cause of action rests on the plan document's provisions, they belong in federal court. But it doesn't automatically get sent to federal court, what's called remove. That's not automatic. The plan has to allege that in a pleading. So in this case, the cause of action was filed in state court. The plan delayed and delayed and delayed, and the reasons aren't important, but it wasn't intentional. There were lots of things going on, lots of moving parts. But at the end of the day, the plan didn't file for removal for almost 2 years. When it finally got to the court, the federal court said, you know what? You've waited way too long. You haven't been diligent. We're not going to give you this right. The entire point of ERISA is to let the plan have its own rights. But if the plan doesn't enforce its own rights, you might as well not have those rights to begin with. So that's the crux of this case. If you have rights, you have to use them. There's no point in having them if you're not going
to
use them.
It's funny you bring up taking ERISA for granted, because we seem to see that a lot when it comes to basically every piece of our industry, every area, every subject that we deal with on a daily basis. People always say, well, we're in ERISA plan. Mm-hmm. Well, you still have to act upon it and make sure that you're not doing anything that violates some other type of law as well.
Yeah, and last note on this case, you know, even if you have the rights and even if you act on them, if you take much too long and you abuse those rights, the courts are going to look at it as if you don't have those rights, or at least are not entitled to use those rights. Ron?
So as far as the DOL FAQ, this relates to reference-based pricing. If you missed the webinar that Adam referenced before, shame on you. I'm not going to tell you all the secret knowledge that we shared then.
But they can go on our website.
Absolutely. Come to the website and find out for yourself. What I will tell you is, ultimately, the FAQ recently released is essentially just a restatement of an FAQ from 2 years ago. What it means, what you need to do in order to offer this kind of cost containment program, this pricing methodology, how to avoid some of the issues. And frankly, if the most conservative bad news interpretation of the FAQ is true, what that means for you, truth is, it's not as bad as you might think. So that's strategy. But like I said, it's really just a restatement. You just need to make sure that you're protecting patients from balance billing. It's not really about RBP, even though they write it as if it's about RBP. The fact is, it's really more about protecting individuals from balance billing. And if you fail to do so, how balance billing is going to impact the plan, max out of pockets, and things of that nature.
So be sure to know that feel free to go on our website, and you could actually listen to the webinar and see all the slides. Or feel free to just email one of us here, our legal department, Chris, John, Ron, myself, and we can help you with any questions you may have on that as well.
Now, the Dennis versus Martinsville case, this one is fantastic. I brought this up a few times recently. It was brought to my attention. It is a small case out of Virginia. The precedent is not that vast in where it's binding, but the logic that the judge uses is very convincing. And really what the judge is doing here is he is relying on or using the same argument that we've been bringing up for a while, which is this concept of quantum merit, and he actually references it by name. And basically what this judge is saying is that healthcare should not be treated different than any other business or commerce or exchange. Whether you're paying somebody to paint your house or paying someone to remove your appendix, ultimately, if someone puts a gun to your head and your life is on the line, you can't be bound to any contract. And furthermore, you can't agree to a price that you don't know. And furthermore, when a vendor is the one who's setting the fee unilaterally and has all the chips and all the sophistication and all the knowledge, they can't just pull numbers out of the air. It needs to be based on some sort of objectively reasonable evidence.
One of the cool things about this case is, you know, literally the day it came out, we already started using this case in many of our arguments, in many of our legal letters. And as we deal with a lot of facilities, we've noticed that having this case as part of our repertoire, as part of our arsenal of weaponry, it's already gone a long way towards ensuring that we can get better than what's available up there on the marketplace.
Absolutely. I mean, you can come up with as many brilliant arguments as you want, but then when you can actually reference a judge in a court who, frankly, is not part of this industry, and yet even he sees the logic behind those arguments, you know, it's easy then to say, wouldn't another judge potentially feel the same way?
Yeah, interestingly, this case deals specifically with emergency care, but in our arguments and letters, we've been experimenting with some arguments related to applying it to all care, because practically speaking, if a patient comes into the emergency room, absolutely, that patient, practically speaking, has no choice. The patient is faced with the choice of your money or your life, as the court said, actually. But when it comes
to, I like that line.
Yeah. When it comes to other care, non-emergent care, if a patient needs a hip replacement, does the patient feel like he has a choice whether to get that hip replacement? Probably not, because the doctor has said, you need a hip replacement. Who is the patient to say, well, you know, I probably don't? Well, no, if a doctor tells you you do, patients think that they do. And not to say that it's not the case, more often than not, when a doctor tells you you need something, you probably need it.
Yeah.
So there's no question of whether the patient thinks that he is just able to say, no, thank you.
I love the term elective, you know. Well, you could elect to have the procedure, or you could elect to live the rest of your life in pain. You know, that's a great choice. Last but not least, I'm sure everybody's heard to one degree or another about the departure of United from the exchange. Again, this was a long time coming. The writing was on the wall for a while. There was a lot of rumors, and then it happened. You know, one, is this just the beginning of a landslide? Can we expect to see large carriers leaving the exchanges in general? Two, what does this mean regarding how the exchanges are structured? You know, why did United leave? Is this something that is just unique to them, or is it symptomatic for all carriers? And three, what is this going to mean for the rest of the industry? You know, those entities that are in support of or who have really pinned their futures on the exchange and on the ACA working the way it's currently drafted, when they look at this and they think, you know, is this the beginning of the end for us and what we want, will they potentially turn their sights on those that, for right or wrong, they blame for the lack of success? You know, when someone like a United says, look, we can't afford to offer this kind of unfettered coverage to high-risk individuals when all of the low-risk individuals that should be offsetting these costs are busy self-funding or something else, you know, are they going to say, you know what, they're right, this adverse selection is a real problem. Let's target self-funding and really knock it down for the benefit of the exchanges. So for those who think this is great news because I hate Obamacare and this is one more proof that it doesn't work, you know, be careful what you wish for, because bad news for the enemy may mean worse news for you.
Just so you guys know, we have a lot of slides and a lot of marketing materials related to the benefits of self-funding. As you know, it's something that we've been pushing everywhere we speak across the country. And one of the big numbers is the fact that ACA plans in the exchanges are running at a 22% higher cost than a typical self-funded employee benefit plan. That is factual information. So if you're looking for information like that, please feel free to reach out to us. Oh, by the way, we keep getting these comments about Jen McCormick not being here, but yeah, we're still talking about Plan Docs. You know, we know that she's very important and people love her, but we felt bad for Chris and didn't want to leave him out. So we'll make sure we leave him out next time. Next slide we want to make sure we go over, and this is a big deal. We could spend the next 45 minutes just on this slide, but we won't because we have a lot of stuff to go over. But I know Ron's going to talk about this. Folks, this is, if you can think of other agreements, let us know. Feel free to text us. But there's a lot of stuff when it comes to self-funding.
Yeah.
This is the kind of, when someone says, oh, can you look at our contracts for us? We're like, which one?
Yeah.
Here you go. So, Ron?
It's funny, too, and Adam will kill me if I reference this, but I got to do it.
No.
You know, the thing is, and I think that it's relatively unique to us, in a lot of ways, all of these contracts and everybody dealing with each other is because of assignment of benefits. And I'm not going to go into detail, but if you think about any other form of insurance, auto insurance, homeowners insurance, you have the policyholder. And there, if you can imagine a graph, the policyholder would be in the center. They've got the policy. And then they have individual contracts with everyone involved. The person who's selling them the car, the person who owes them cash, their insurance. And they're at the center of it. But because of assignment of benefits, you know, the consumer removes themselves, and now everybody who used to service that consumer now has to deal with each other.
Do you have to use assignment of benefits in no matter what? I mean, I can put a picture of Donald Duck on this slide, and he's going to bring up assignment of benefits.
Well, Donald Duck assigned his pants to somebody. But so when I look at this contract, I mean, and the problem is, if all of these contracts...
The business associate agreement. We just got an email text.
Sweet.
Great.
You know what? And business associate agreements refer to HIPAA. HIPAA protects people's patient, the protected health information, which is only being shared with outsiders because of that assignment of benefits. Anyway,
so
when you look at this slide, I mean, ultimately, if all of these contracts and agreements don't jive with one another, there's going to be a problem.
For the sake of time, one of the big things you want to look at here, look at the employee handbook and collective bargaining agreements. Where we're seeing major pushback from carriers regarding reimbursement relates to patient eligibility. What you're seeing right now is major gaps where what the employee handbook says allows someone to be covered under the plan versus to what the plan document says or the collective bargaining agreement say are many times extremely different.
Absolutely.
So you could actually have people who aren't necessarily supposed to be covered under the terms of the plan but are covered under the terms of the employee handbook, get an ID card, get treatment, our process, the claims are processed by the administrator. They don't know any better because they think they're covered. But the stop-loss carrier is offering reimbursement based on the terms of the plan doc only.
Right, not the
handbook. Nothing else. And that's where we're seeing a lot of the eligibility and basically mismanagement. It's hard to blame anyone except for the fact that people just aren't looking to see if the employee handbook or collective bargaining agreement is offering a service or a benefit to an employee that isn't exactly the same as the plan doc. We're seeing more and more when it comes to this. You guys obviously know about all the gaps in the stop-loss policies. You know about all these things. But at the end of the day, if we could share a couple of things. One, you need to make sure that when you purchase stop-loss, you include any and all amendments and carve-outs with the plan doc. Because that, otherwise, that amendment doesn't exist to the carrier. They have no idea about it. You can't bring it up later on. So if you've amended the plan, make sure it's part of your policy with the stop-loss carrier. When it comes to network agreements, we hear this all the time on the road, Ron. Well, you know, my plan document is a self-funded ERISA plan. It governs everything. No, it doesn't.
Right.
95% of your claims are going to be governed by the network contract because they're in-network claims. It doesn't matter what the plan doc says. If you agreed to a network contract stating that you're not a single claim, it doesn't matter if the plan doc says you're going to audit every single claim.
Right. I mean, look at it this way. If you are an employer or a plan sponsor, you have a plan document that says you're going to do ABC, and then you sign a PPO contract that says you're going to do XYZ, and those two can't work together. It's not the provider or the network's fault that you went and agreed to do something that you don't have the right or ability to do. So if it hits the fan and you're ultimately going to be held responsible for what you agreed to do, you're the one who's responsible, not the network. So, again, and I'm glad that plan document is at the center of the graph, and it makes a lot of sense. The problem is the plan document is what sets forth the rights, the powers of the plan, and yet I feel as if most employers take the plan document and put it on the back burner and focus entirely on their employee handbooks, their network contracts. It's almost like too much attention is paid on those other contracts and not enough on the plan document. But ultimately, stop loss, I feel it might be the only one who's focused entirely on the plan document, and they don't care about those other contracts.
I think it's funny. I can tell you, I think we set a record, guys. We set a record because this is the most questions we've ever received on a single slide, maybe because it's just so colorful. I don't know why. All the arrows. But a couple things. One, the business associate agreement I don't think is on here because compared to all these agreements, the BAA probably offers the least number of issues for us.
I've never seen a BAA conflict with anything on here. There are occasionally confidentiality and HIPAA-type provisions within these contracts, but because HIPAA is so standard and, frankly, because the Department of Health and Human Security, Health and Human Services, I'm sorry, publishes a template BAA, there's typically no gaps anywhere, but it's still a great suggestion.
Right. Another thing I want to make sure we bring up is people bring up, you know, what about the network agreement? Who signs it? So I want to go over the ASA really quick and how it ties into the network agreement. There are TPAs out there that sign an administrative service agreement with the plan. And there are TPAs that have the plan automatically agree to the terms of the network contract without the actual plan having to sign the network contract. And there are those TPAs that make every one of their employer groups sign their own network contract. We've seen both, and they both can work. But what scares us is the many situations we see where there is nothing anywhere signed by any group agreeing to the terms of any network contract, yet every member of that employer group is walking around with an ID card with that network logo. That is something that I want to bring up a little bit later as well. In addition, I want to make sure we talked about the PBM agreements. This is probably the most hidden or confusing document as it relates to all these agreements. It probably has the most amount of, I would say, the unknown. And John is the guy that probably knows PBMs better than anybody. But that is a great unknown in our industry. Most of our clients, our TPA clients, have no idea what these PBM agreements even say. So real quick question we had about, are we going to send out the presentation? No, we are not sending this presentation to anyone. This is the only time you're ever going to see these slides. So if you got to take a picture of your screen, do it, because we're never going to share them. John?
Not only is the webinar being recorded and will be posted to our website in just a couple of days, but if you look in your panel, a copy of the PDF version of the slides that we're presenting right now are attached as a handout. You can actually download them as we speak. So I hope that answers your question in one way or the other. And last but not least, we've gotten another question. What about consistency between the plan document and the stop-loss contract? Well, that's an issue that we could talk about for days, and we will talk about it momentarily.
All right. So great. Thank you for the lead.
You guys are all asking us questions that we think some of these answers are going to be in later slides. So we skip a couple of these slides going forward. It's not our fault. It's yours.
Yeah, we could literally just stuck on the graph and just done the whole presentation. So now that we've gotten past that graph, that web of stop loss,
So, one, people ask about what about issues between the stop loss and the plan document and coordinating between the two. You know, we coined the phrase about minding the gap, you know, hard gaps being the difference in actual verbiage, illegal acts versus just felonies, soft gaps being issues, differences in interpretation of the same language, right? Someone references the word reasonable, right, or what providers in an area charge without defining what the term area means. Everyone could agree to the same exact word, but have different definitions of what that word means. Granted that that is an issue and that is something that needs to be resolved, but understand that this is a conflict between the plan document and stop loss. But inherently, for there to be a conflict between the plan document and stop loss, we need to be talking about the plan document. At least you are dealing with the most important document of the bunch, the plan document.
I think it's great. I don't know who came out. I'm assuming it's John. Where you call the plan document the seed from which all other relationships grow. That's perfect. I mean, it's literally, I never thought of it that way, but it makes sense. At the end of the day, the plan doc to us is really where a plan is putting down, this is what I want for my employees. This is what I want to cover. This is what I don't want to cover. This is what the eligibility requirements are. It makes a lot of sense, and it's important to have a very concise one. Right. But tying from that seed, there's no question, everything else basically grows based off whatever is in within that seat. So I love that analogy.
My concern is that too many employers, you know, that's what the plan document is, and then they disregard it. So, for instance, you look at the handbook, employers are going to spend days, weeks, months, you know, mulling over what they want their handbook to say. Oh, if somebody, you know, has an injury or they're disabled, are we going to keep offering them benefits? Of course, we love our employees, give them benefits. And then they don't update the plan document. They look at the plan document and they think, oh, yeah, my TPA does that for me. I don't need to look at it. I don't need to know what it says. But meanwhile, it ultimately then conflicts with that plan document. My concern is that these handbooks are writing checks that their SPDs can't cash. And then it's, once you deal with that issue, you know, stop loss doesn't have to reimburse if it's outside the coverage set by the plan document. You know, the example is that an animal like this one, you've got stop loss insurance for your minivan, but you're out there driving around in a Maserati. If you end up having an accident, guess what? Insurance is not going to reimburse you. So, again, whenever you're obtaining any kind of coverage or protection for your plan, you need to make sure that those are the terms by which you're administering the claim.
I did a presentation yesterday on behalf of a 2 days ago on behalf of a stop loss carrier. They called the session Beyond the Spreadsheet, which I thought was a great title, because what they're trying to get brokers to do for the first time is to look at stop loss policies as more than just what the actual cost of the premium is, but actually to look at the policy terms and what it actually covers. But it's very important. Even when you have stop-loss carriers that say, we will mirror the terms of the plan, remember, the amendments and carve-outs can change the plan, so include them. And your employee handbooks and collective bargaining agreements can supplement the plan document, but offer different eligibility terms than what the stop-loss carrier agreed to reimburse. So it's very important, folks, that even though you're mirroring the plan, does the plan mirror all the other agreements that you have in place?
Now, again, you have to also understand, you know, I feel like too often we end up talking about the plan, the TPA, the stop loss, you know, maybe the network, maybe the provider. And what we do is we forget that between each of those entities, there's an agreement. Because here we are referencing all those entities, but then ultimately we're talking about the stop loss policy, the network contract, and the plan document as if that's it. And the purpose of the presentation today is to talk about the other contracts and the other agreements that are the mortar between those bricks. And one other contract that I think is often disregarded or ignored is that administrative services agreement. Because ultimately, let's say I have an employer, a plan sponsor. And, you know, they, like I said, they've worked very, very hard on their employee handbook. You know, they know what they want to do. They know what they want to cover. You know, they signed a stop loss policy, but they didn't really look at it. You know, they signed off on a plan document, but they didn't really look at it. They signed off on their network contract, but they didn't really look at that. The only thing they really concerned themselves with was the thing that they thought they were responsible for, the handbook that they write and they distribute to their employees. So who, then, is responsible for those other contracts? Chances are they think it's either their broker or their TPA. You're the expert. You're the one I hired for this purpose. Well, then my question is, what does your ASA say about it? And furthermore, are you doing the things in accordance with that ASA? Or worse, are you doing things above and beyond what that contract says? At its very core, I ask you, why take on additional responsibility or liability that you're not even charging for? First of all, you should be compensated for it. But secondly, from a legal perspective, you're also, A, creating liability for yourself, and B, you're creating certain expectations. You know, if I'm a TPA, and it's my client, the plan's responsibility, to decide what they want in their plan document, not only for the fiduciary reasons, but to also make sure everyone's on the same page regarding what the coverage limits are, so that we can have the handbook and everything match it. But I don't want to trouble them. It's too much work. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to give them the plan document that I wrote for them. Well, yeah, guess what? Every year that that plan renews with me, they're going to expect me to do the same thing. So if suddenly year three or year four, the fee group tells me, hey, get the plan involved, make sure the employer knows what's in their plan document, or there may be a conflict, for me to turn around and say to that plan, well, you know, my ASA, it says I never should have done this for you. I've just been doing you a solid all these years. At some point, that precedent starts to take hold. So you really have to be very careful about what you're doing and make sure that it matches with your contract. Network contracts, we've talked about this till we were blue in the face. Ultimately, if the network contract says that the plan is going to do one thing and the plan document says they're going to do something else, whose fault is that? The one who's best positioned to know what the plan says, review the network contract, and identify the conflicts is probably the plan.
So we're getting a lot of questions relating to this issue regarding network contracts and how can a network contract override a plan's fiduciary duties, etc. Here's the bottom line, folks. We can agree with you till you're blue in the, till we're blue in the face. The bottom line is, when these cases go to court, they're typically in state court. The state court, what we learned in the first day of contracts class in law school, a court is going to, when there's a contract dispute, they're going to look at the four corners of the contract. They're not going to look beyond that. So they're not going to look at anything else. If you agreed in a network contract to do X and you don't do X, you're going to be found in breach of that contract. Simple. It's as simple as that.
Right, guys. Two issues. One, sometimes the provider of the network, they're not suing the plan. They're suing the employer. I don't know if you're aware, but the plan document, the plan, the self-funded benefit plan, and the employer are two separate legal entities with separate tax IDs, tax code, employer numbers. If the employer signs a contract saying that they're going to do something, it doesn't matter what the plan says. I'm going to make sure that the employer is responsible. Or let's say it's the TPA who signed off on the network contract. We've seen this. They sue the TPA. Whoever signed as a payer in the network contract, they're the one who's going to be sued. So they're not going after the plan for the money. They're going after the employer. The second issue, they may not be looking for payment of the medical bill. Specifically, they're looking for damages because by signing a contract, they relied on you signing that contract that they were going to be paid in accordance with that contract. And if you had some pre-existing legal obligation that prevents you from fulfilling that contract, I'm suing you for breach, not for medical, not for expenses owed, but breach. And that's a whole separate group of damages.
All right, Ron, now it's time to breathe.
Woo.
Thanks. So, what are you looking out for in the plan doc? Okay, guys, there's three different things. One, who is the fiduciary? The plan document is going to state who the fiduciary is for the plan, who makes the plan decisions. Now, I get this all the time from brokers. Well, we want to do this. We want to do that. We want to carve out dialysis. We want to create a narrow network. We want direct contract with providers. We want to do all these things. I say, did you look at your administrative service agreement? Who has the right to make all of these decisions? In the ASO world, it's typically the carrier. In the TPA world, it's typically the plan. So you got to look at who the fiduciary is, not only in the plan doc, but also in the ASA. But more importantly, the third leg, who is acting as the fiduciary? So even though your plan doc says the plan makes any and all decisions, the ASA says the plan is responsible for everything. The TPA, we are just pressing buttons. We aren't doing anything but processing. If your correspondence, and please, if you're a TPA on this phone, on the call, please, after this session's over, look at your typical template documents. Who's denying the claim? Who's asking for more information related to a claim? Who's responding on an appeal? Is it your company responding with your letterhead? Or does it say XYZ TPA on behalf of the XYZ self-funded employee benefit plan? Who is making the call? If your friend outside the industry would read that letter and think that the TPA is the one that's making the decision, then you're the fiduciary. Fact. simple, clean. Who has the subro rights? A very important thing to look at, especially in light of the new Montanil case that Chris has talked to you guys ad nauseum on. We've done a lot of work to make sure we're very innovative and that we're very proactive when it comes to this thing. But you want to make sure you have the best rights when it comes to recovery, because your stop-loss contract as well will have a provision related to who gets reimbursed first and whether or not they have to reduce what they get by fees, collection, and or attorney's fees. Do you pay out-of-network providers too much? 99% of the people on this phone are. We feel there's a better way to deal with out-of-network claims. Instead of just paying it through wrap networks, we feel that one of the things that we've noticed with reference-based pricing is that for those employers who aren't ready to replace their network, at least they're ready to replace their network on out-of-network claims and how they're being repriced, paid, and obtained sign-off on. So that's one of the things that we're able to offer here at FIA. Last but not least, are you compliant? The number one thing that the Department of Labor right now is finding through their audits is that many plans are not compliant. Either A, they don't have a plan doc, or the ones that do have provisions within the terms of their plan that are not in compliance with current ACA and or state law requirements. So I can tell you here at FIA, unlike a typical ERISA attorney that only look at compliance, we make sure that we have the compliance and the cost containment avenues covered on behalf of our clients here in the industry. John?
Thanks. So we'll talk about amendments and carve-outs for a little bit now. Now, the discussion of the SPD that Ron and Adam have just made, it's very, very similar to the discussion of amendments and carve-outs. And the reason for that is because amendments and carve-outs become a part of the SPD, whether it's redlined into the document for your next restatement or a separate amendment added on to the end, it's part of the plan document. So the essence of an amendment is making a change to the plan or treating some services differently, and that's also what we use the word or the term carve-out to describe. Now, when we think of carve-outs, where my mind jumps to is dialysis, but there are lots of other kind of carve-outs. There are carve-outs for service types and for particular types of treatment. I mean, a carve-out is really any benefit that's treated differently from the average benefit within the plan. So as I mentioned, carve-outs and amendments are an extension of the SPD. And what does that mean? They must be followed strictly, just like the SPD. ERISA imposes a duty on the plan administrator to do exactly what the SPD says. The plan administrator is not legally allowed to deviate from what the plan says. If the plan says X and the plan administrator does Y, the plan administrator could easily be liable for a breach of that fiduciary duty, even if it's to the provider's benefit or to a patient's benefit. Same thing with discrimination. An amendment or a carve-out must be non-discriminatory, just like the SPD must be non-discriminatory. When we talk about compliance, largely what we're talking about is the ACA and ERISA, HIPAA, COBRA, GINA, you name it, there's a law for it. When it comes to carve-outs, though, a lot of the discrimination we see is actually when they are implemented. So, for instance, if you have a patient that currently needs dialysis and you say, you know what, I want to carve this out because it costs too much, it's discriminatory if you just carve it out right then and there because it's based specifically on an individual who needs that dialysis. It's a problem. There are ways of doing it in a non-discriminatory fashion. And spoiler alert, one of them, or really the main one, is to wait until the first day of the next plan year, and our consulting department can help with any type of carve-out discrimination issues if you want to email us again at pgcreferral@fiagroup.com. But at the end of the day, discrimination, huge issue with carve-outs. People have a lot of trouble understanding why a carve-out might be discriminatory, and the nature of a carve-out suggests that it kind of is discriminatory if it is implemented because of a certain person. But there are certain ways to remove that discrimination because the law does realize, well, sometimes when you want to lower costs, it's because your costs are already high, not because you fear that they one day may become high. So there are ways to mitigate that. And last but not least, stop loss. Must be aware of it. If you have a stop loss policy underwritten based on the plan document, but you don't include a carve-out or an amendment, you're in a lot of trouble. The case that we talked about a few webinars ago, for the life of me, I can't remember the name, but the broker placed stop loss on behalf of the group and forgot to include a widowed spouse's amendment.
Right.
the widowed spouse incurred hundreds of thousands of dollars in claim, and the stop-loss carrier said, I didn't know that that was an amendment the plan had. It was never submitted to us. Not only was the broker held liable as a fiduciary, but there was no stop-loss reimbursement for that claim. Needless to say, it is problematic. So what to look out for? Of course, are you violating a PPO agreement? Are you violating a PBM agreement? Carve-outs for high-cost drugs can easily run afoul of the PBM agreement. Likewise, carve-outs for dialysis, for example, because it's the easiest example.
This is the number one thing where we have seen lawsuits, is carving out dialysis. Dialysis facilities that are actually in-network. So while it works for a while, what we have seen is 2-3 years down the road, that network and or that facility sue on behalf of sue the plan and or its administrator for violating the terms of the actual network agreement. Even though the plan doc says to pay the claims at Medicare plus 25, when they get sued 2-3 years down the road, there is no stop-loss coverage. That stop-loss has been gone years ago.
Right. Facilities like Fresenius and DaVita, they do their absolute best to make sure that they are included in every network so that carve-outs like this will not apply to them. They buy out their competitors to make sure that they're not out of network, because if they're out of network, they could be paid based on Medicare, and balanced billing is often not a possibility due to Medicare rules. But when they're in network, you can bet that the network contract is not going to let you do this. So please, we implore you, if you want to implement carve-outs for dialysis, cancer, hemophilia, make sure that you don't apply it when the network contract specifically prohibits it.
Or see at least if there's a way for you to carve out those particular facilities within the network contract itself.
So really quickly, I'll touch on the stop-loss policy here. You all know what stop-loss is. I'm not going to give you an introduction to stop-loss because you wouldn't be on this call if you didn't already have some familiarity with stop-loss. And, you know, even that, we've talked about it already. I mean, you can't talk about the plan document without referencing stop-loss. So stop-loss underwrites the SPD only. If you don't give it your carve-outs, it's not going to know they're there. If you don't show it your network contract or have language in the plan, it's not going to know that it's there. All the documents that we're talking about today can cause gaps in coverage with stop-loss if claims are paid based on those documents instead of based strictly on the plan document. And as one of our local clients or one of our local stop-loss partners recently said in this analogy, all the documents are having a party, and they don't call stop-loss until it's time to clean them up.
Yeah. Now this slide right here, I think, is very important, going back to that whole beyond the spreadsheet. This, John, if you could touch base, what are some of the things that you need to look for at a stop-loss policy? I can tell you this. The longer the stop-loss policy is, the more problems that you're going to have with that policy. So if you got a nice 10, 11, 12-page stop-loss policy, you already know it's better than the ones that are 20 pages long.
Right. So, of course, it's not realistic. But if you had a one-page policy that said, if it's payable by the plan, it's payable by the carrier, like I said, unrealistic. I mean, from an underwriting perspective, that's just a nightmare. And there are also, you know, payment provisions, et cetera. But, yes, in general, the shorter the policy, the fewer exclusions and separate definitions and limitations it has. I mean, for instance, I saw a stop-loss policy the other day that had a page and a half defining what is medically necessary. Well, the way we look at it from a stop-loss perspective, as long as the plan has its own language about medically necessary, the policy doesn't even really need to have it. You know, if the plan's language says, it's medically necessary if we say it is, well, yes, that's awful language, and the carrier needs to do something about that. But a page and a half, you've got to be kidding me. You know, as long as the plan document has decent language, carriers can't forget that they have the discretion to interpret that language as well. So you don't need your own language. Shorten the policy, you know, make sure it's as concise as possible, and we like to use the phrase mirroring the plan document. Now, that phrase is one that we like to use. It's not an official term. It's not used by regulators. But basically, it refers to incorporating the terms of the plan rather than writing your own plan document, essentially, in the stop-loss policy, because, as, like I said, as long as the plan's language is decent, the carrier can rely on it and interpret it as it sees fit, even if those interpretations are different from the plan. Now, sometimes that can be a problem, but at the same time, more stop-loss exclusions and definitions, those are a problem as well.
When it comes to having the carrier keep the claims open, this is very important relating to any claim that doesn't get sign-off. No question about it. I don't care if it's reference-based pricing. Any situation where there is no sign-off on a claim, but it's not a network contract, because the network claim already automatically assumes sign-off on the claim by the facility, you want to see if that carrier will keep that particular claim open. We have seen a lot of situations where plans have been left high and dry, specifically because claims weren't left open, and the administrator forgot or didn't tell their carrier about claims in order to keep them open beyond the stop-loss policy year. So very important, when you sign a stop-loss contract, is it a 12-12, is it a 12-15, 12-18, 12-24 contract? All that kind of stuff matters. Finally, turn it over to you, Chris, talk about the employees and the promises we make to them.
Thanks,
sorry,
Adam.
If I made promises to you, Chris, that I've broken.
Oh, that's okay, Adam. I don't take any of your promises seriously anymore.
Wow, that's nice. That's really nice. Isn't your review coming up this week? Great job.
No, but seriously, folks, Adam already talked about this a little bit. It's, you know, it's important to say the first bullet there says that these types of issues are rare, but one of the reasons they're rare is because even people within the industry don't even understand that the employee handbook and or that these collective bargaining agreements come into play more often than not. I'll tell you what, though, a lot of stop-loss people understand that they come into play because you do make statements to your employees in these documents. And as more and more, as self-funding becomes more and more prominent with all the new lives that are coming, I think an interesting place that we might see a lot more of these issues is with programs to incentivize employees to shop around and to find providers, right? Your network agreements don't necessarily want you incentivizing your employees better care.
Exactly. The network contracts specifically state that you're not allowed to provide or incentivize steerage. However, your employee handbooks many times do that, just like ours.
So how do you do that? And the problem is that employee plan sponsors are thinking, okay, well, we'll put it in the employee handbook, and then we'll just deal with it through the plan. But now you can't do that because you've made promises to an employee that you have to comply with. But you thought you were going to pay it out of the plan, and now you can't pay it out of the plan. And so it's really important to do these things, right? So these are some of the standards that we've seen over the years, and obviously with stop loss, these come up a lot. What does actively at work mean? Providing disability benefits or promises of disability benefits in the handbook and or in the collective bargaining agreement, but then those aren't in the plan or they're not defined the same in the plan. And like we just said, you're going to have a problem when even if your stop-loss policy mirrors your plans to the, to the letter, this stuff isn't in your plan, and therefore you've got all kinds of breaches flying around.
The approved leave of absence provisions, that is a very problematic area. Remember this, folks. It's much easier for someone to deny, a stop-loss carrier to deny your claim if the claim should never have been considered in the first place. That's the easiest way. Much better than UNC, much better than having the right to audit. Can we negotiate the claim? At the end of the day, you should never have received that claim in the first place because the person not even covered for eligibility under the terms of the plan. That's probably one of those situations where you're like, oh, man, we're screwed. So look for that in your handbooks.
Again, important to know, Adam earlier, Adam's comment about the promises. Not all promises equate to contracts, but some promises can equate to contracts. So it's important to consider that. And obviously, look, the ASA, it's one of the most basic agreements. Everyone has them. And look, one of the most basic concepts in the ASA is this concept of fiduciaries, right? Who is a fiduciary? Newsflash, there are two ways you can be a fiduciary. You can be a named fiduciary or you can act like a fiduciary. Just because you're not named a fiduciary doesn't mean you aren't acting like one. And it's important to understand what's in that ASA because, Adam was talking about Subro earlier. We have clients all the time that, they don't provide robust Subro services because they're not using our Subro, but they do have, in the ASA, it specifically says that they're going to provide subrogation. Have you breached a fiduciary duty? Are you a fiduciary when you decide not to provide robust Subro services, but your ASA has promised to the plan that you are going to provide subrogation services? The plan will say yes, and I think most courts would agree, you're making decisions on behalf of the plan without the plan's sign-off.
If your ASA agreement has cobwebs on it, we'd recommend you open it up, clean it off, take out the cobwebs, dust it off, because the industry has changed, folks. We're seeing a lot more in how administrators and ASOs are charging for services, more about savings opportunities, less about admin-type work. We're seeing now administrators realizing they're more like advisors. They're offering legal services, consultative services, plan drafting services. You're no longer just administering a plan. You now have to be looked upon almost as an expert in healthcare reform just because of what's been happening over the past couple of years. So having the ability to charge for some of these things and outlining them within your ASA is very important. And we can tell you that when we look at our standard, I mean, our own standard ASA that we offer to our clients, if you look at it 5 years ago, you compare it to it now, it's a total different contract. So very important for people to know. So I know we talked about this one. I want to make sure we turn to John and focus a little bit more on the network agreement, specifically, you know, what my favorite definition is, a clean claim.
Oh, I love clean claims. So, yeah, you know, similar to stop loss, you all know what network agreements are. I'm not going to get into the 101 course. I'm going to go right to a graduate course. You know, the network agreement defines the payment mechanisms and timeframes. Now, what does that mean? It depends. It all depends on the particular network agreement in play. Now, there's, primary networks and wrap networks and pre-negotiated discounts that kind of don't fit either of those molds. But what they all have in common is that, for the most part, they're all very restrictive. And, you know, auditing is something that plan administrators and TPAs need to do to contain costs. If you can't perform an audit, you can't look at your own claims data, and you can't determine what should be paid. Well, guess what? If you sign a network contract, chances are you're not allowed to determine what can be paid anyway, because the network determines it for you. So when you look at a network contract, you have to look at it in relation to the SPD. And on one of the previous slides, it said that the plan document is sometimes made irrelevant by the network contract. And what that is designed to mean is that when the network contract says if a service is covered by the plan, it's payable at bill charges minus 10%, for example, or bill charges minus 30% if you're really lucky, right? Whatever the plan document says it will pay, even if it says it'll, you know, subject in-network providers to usual and customary, you can't. There are some network contracts out there that are drafted so poorly as to actually allow the plan to use provisions like that. But for the most part, don't even think about it.
I want to make sure we give enough credit to John here on this. You know, you can go to Ron for anything and myself for anything, but when you have a network issue, we would recommend you going to John with it, because basically we have access to most of the network contracts that are out there. Some of the regional ones, maybe we don't. But pretty much, if it's a network contract, we have seen it, we have access to it, and I would say that John has a great idea as to what those provisions particularly say. Because there are some that you can do a lot more with because specifically they're just written poorly or sloppily. So,
yeah, I mean, Adam mentioned on the last slide, you know, if your ASA has cobwebs, let us review it. Well, you know, as much as we would love to tell networks the same thing, they're not going to have us review their contracts because we'll make them better. That's not what they're looking for. So when you're talking about plan drafting in relation to the network agreement, you have to make sure that the plan adopts the network agreement. What that means is that for in-network claims, the plan document shouldn't say, we're going to audit based on usual and customary and pay 140% of Medicare. No, you're not. You're just not, because the network agreement says you can't. So what the plan has to say is, if it's in-network, we'll pay a contracted rate, period. There's some leeway there. You know, maybe you can negotiate, but at the end of the day, you don't want to put yourself in a position where the plan says one thing that contradicts the network contract saying a completely different thing.
One of the things you might want to look at doing, too, is from a stop-loss perspective, if you are a plan and you have a mirroring provision from a stop-loss carrier, but your plan document has language tying it to we're going to pay what's reasonable, we're going to audit claims, et cetera, one of the things you might want to do is go to your carrier and go, listen, we understand that you understand that we have access to a Blue Cross Blue Shield network. We have to pay in-network claims pursuant to the Blue Cross Blue Shield network. So get them on page one of the policy to write down in the comment section that all in-network claims will be paid based on the network contract. That way you don't have to worry about any breaching of any mirroring clauses that may occur.
Yeah, you know, despite the fact that stop-loss and networks are so well ingrained in the industry that everybody knows that they're both constantly around, most stop-loss policies, and, you know, just about all, I would say, I mean, I've only actually seen a handful that don't do this, the vast majority of stop-loss policies don't say that whatever your network rate is, that's the carrier's UNC. Most carriers specify that their UNC is the prevailing charge in the area, or what's reasonable based on objective criteria such as Medicare rates, etc. Basically, the carrier is allowed to perform a clinical audit while the plan is forced to pay per the network contract. Needless to say, that is a very, very significant gap in coverage that can cause hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses to the plan. And, you know, one more thing to touch on before we move away from this. Clean claims. When is a claim clean? If you look in your plan document, it may or may not define a clean claim. And side note, if it doesn't, it should. So let us know if your plan document doesn't talk about when a claim is clean or payable, because we can help you revise that. But according to most network contracts, a claim is clean when it is submitted,
received
on a UB or a HICFA, and that's it. I mean, that definition says almost nothing. I mean, every claim is submitted, and
that's why it's a claim.
Right, that's the whole point.
If it's a claim, the definition of a claim is that it has to exist.
Exactly. Something that I've discussed numerous times with certain networks, I'm not going to name any names now, is that the definition of clean claim is absolutely meaningless. You might as well just not capitalize it and write claim. Because basically you're saying, as long as the provider says the charges are due, then the charges are due.
Right.
That's not how most plan documents work. TPAs need to get accident details, and they need to look at the bills, get an itemization, see invoices, etc. But the network contract says, you got the bill, pay the bill.
Now we're going to turn it over to Ron to talk about our favorite, the least known and most mysterious agreement that we have that exists in our industry today.
Yeah, it's a little, when you think about it so far, we've spent almost an hour now talking about medical plans and medical networks and medical stop loss and medical. And it's amazing. With all the pre-certification and utilization review and the contract review and the audits and things that we're doing on the health and medical side, how little are we doing as far as the cost of our drugs, our prescriptions? It's incredible. But the level of attention that we pay to everything else, if you could imagine paying the same level of attention to the drug spend and Rx and prescription spend, my God. I mean, I look at, and it's a rare thing if you can get your hands on it, but the kinds of issues that we see in our PBM scenarios that you wouldn't even imagine seeing in the worst of other network scenarios. The purpose of the PBM, it appears, based on the contracting and the expectations of them, is that they are going to arrange for the purchase of drugs, that they are going to secure some sort of a rebate. But where are the rebates going? Why are the drugs being purchased in the first place? Who's following up to make sure that it's the proper medication or that it's being used properly or that it's medically necessary or how long it should continue? It's like the Wild West of our industry. It's, Adam likes to mention, Ron Popeil said it and forget it, and unfortunately, that's the way these arrangements are currently structured, is that you just set it and forget it, and there's no oversight.
The reason why there's no oversight, you have a lot of set it and forget it, is because no one ever cared about drug spend previously. What we have seen now with the rise of high-cost specialty drugs and drug spend taking on such a significant role, stop-loss carriers now are seeing drug expenses for the first time where they didn't see them before. This is the reality. If you're looking to find out who the best of the worst are when it comes to PBM, and that's what we call PBM contracts, the best of the worst, you know, contact us. We know, we have an idea as to where the rebates are going, whether or not there's transparency. This is the key thing. Whatever PBM that you're working with, take a step back and think of this. Are they benefiting? Do they make money by pushing certain drugs to my population? If a drug is expensive, do they make more? Is there a tie between the two? It would be as if FIA, as a consultant, we know that if we refer or we answer the question as X, we're going to make more money. Then why would we ever answer the question Y? We're going to answer it as X every single time because there's a conflict there. That is one of the biggest things you need to look at from in-network claims. Another big question we get when it comes to Rx is Canada. We're asked all the time, is it legal to buy drugs from Canada? We have done and want to continue to do memorandums of our legal opinion as to whether or not it's quote-unquote legal or allowable to purchase drugs from Canada. All we can say is this, without going to jail, is that what we have seen right now is almost a don't ask, don't tell policy that Clinton had with the military back in the 90s. It's, we have seen, because we write the plan docs, many, and I mean many, municipalities, cities, and counties buying drugs from overseas. And these are city plans. So, again, it's a tough question that can't be answered. There's a lot to it. But just understand that these are some of the things that we can look at.
That's selective enforcement. I mean, I could ask you, is it legal to drive 65 in a 55? But I know I went past a cop on the side of the road today doing 65 in a 55. One question that keeps coming up, and I just want to address it very quickly. A lot of people are asking, you know, how can a network force a plan to pay something that's fraudulent or a duplicate charge or excluded by the plan or something like that? And I know some people mentioned that Sutter lawsuit in California. Please understand, we are not suggesting that a network contract which aids and abets fraud or would try to get someone to pay for a supply or service that was never even provided, that that's enforceable. Understand that we're specifically saying that if the service or supply is provided and the plan document says that it's going to pay $10,000 for that service and the network contract says you're going to pay $100,000 for that service, no one is questioning whether the service itself is a covered service, and no one is questioning whether the service was actually provided. The only question is how much you pay for it. The network contract is going to bind the employer. The plan document is going to bind the plan.
A question we get all the time is, doesn't the network contract override the plan, or doesn't the plan override the network contract? The answer to both of those questions is no. They are separate obligations. One is under ERISA, one is under state contract law. They are very, very different. Neither one overrides the other.
So to conclude, as far as the PBM is concerned, I think the same kinds of issues that we've seen in medical are going to become issues here as well. People are going to ask, you know, who's deciding what kind of treatment should be received? Who's deciding what should be paid for it? Who's benefiting from any kind of refunds or rebates? What's the purpose of a discount if the charges are unfettered? Who's making the payment decisions? Who's making the treatment decisions? Who's following up to make sure that it's still necessary? Who controls or customizes the agreement? Does the agreement conflict with my plan terms? Does stop loss cover the same things I'm required to pay per the contract? Is this just a resource to obtain treatment and discounts, or is it an advocate on the part of my plan to keep the cost down? These are all questions that have been asked in the medical field and are questions we're now asking in the PBM field as well.
There's no question we're seeing more and more PBM contract analysis questions and projects. We have seen more already this year than we did all of last year. So we have a feeling the trend is going that way for people to actually ask a lot of these questions to see what's available. All right, with that, we ran out of time. Guys, again, we have over 50 questions and comments that we just cannot go over. Maybe we could do a separate webinar just on the questions.
They're like a page each, too.
Some people just have a lot of typing skills. They could just write forever. However, we have our next webinar on June 14th. We're going to bring Jen McCormick back because people like Joni Verinder at GPA keep asking for her to come back. So, Joni, this is for you. We will bring her back on June 14th, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Our focus will be on Plan Document 101. On behalf of Chris, John, Ron, and myself, thank you so much for spending the last hour with us. We know a lot of you have said, keep drink some decaf coffee. We're just excited to be here. It's awesome. The weather's finally getting nice. Thank you so much for believing in our company, and see you next month.